Chapter 5. History versus Myth in Humanity's Quest for Meaning. In 1956, the year in which the Buddhist world celebrated the 2500th anniversary of the Buddha's enlightenment, I found myself in New Delhi at the invitation of the Indian government, along with other, quote, prominent Buddhists from the border areas, as the government was pleased to style us. I suppose they had in mind a picture of Aboriginal Buddhists turning up from the jungles of Assam and West Bengal, and actually we did look a very motley bunch, in robes of all shades of red and orange and yellow. Of all the celebrations and speeches and events that went on, the most interesting from my point of view was an exhibition of Asian Buddhist art. At that time, it was probably one of the biggest such exhibitions ever mounted anywhere in the world. And all the different Buddhist countries, Japan, Cambodia, Thailand, Bhutan, Tibet, and so on, had their own sections. After the Indian section, which was vast, the biggest and perhaps the most important collection was that organized by the People's Republic of China. This was still in the palmy days of Indo-Chinese friendship before the 1962 border war. Some of the Chinese exhibits were magnificent. I had never seen anything like them. And I remember one especially. A full-scale copy of an ancient mural painting which occupied the whole of one wall. It dated, as far as I remember, from the Tang Dynasty, or perhaps even earlier, and it depicted a number of figures, all more or less life-size. But there were two of these figures occupying the centre of the picture that particularly stood out. To the left, under a jewelled canopy, a beautiful young man was seated on a magnificent lotus throne. He was clad in all manner of silks and jewels, and surrounded by standing yellow-robed figures. From the position of his hands and fingers, his mudra, he seemed to be saying something to the other main figure, who was seated to the right within a sort of curtained pavilion. This was a very old man. His face was covered with tiny wrinkles, and he had a long, white, rather wispy beard. He wore a blue-grey robe, the traditional robe of the Chinese scholar, though this was, as we shall see, artistic license, and he was surrounded by more standing figures in white robes. From the position of his hands and fingers, he seemed to be replying to the young man. The two figures were, of course, Manjushri, the Bodhisattva of Wisdom, on the left, and Vimalakirti, the wise elder of Vaishali, on the right. The painting illustrates the famous meeting between them, which is described at the beginning of Chapter 5 of the Vimalakirti Nidesha, the Consolation of the Invalid. As we saw in the last chapter, all the arhants and bodhisattvas present in the Buddha's assembly were reluctant to go to inquire after Vimalakirti's health. This was because each and every one of them had had a painful, perhaps even rather embarrassing, encounter with Vimalakirti, which had exposed the limitations of their particular approach to the Dharma. We will take up the story at the beginning of Chapter 5, at which point Manjushri has just agreed to visit the invalid. He is fully aware of the difficulties and dangers of the undertaking. He knows that if you come into contact with such a powerful current of spiritual electricity as Vimalakirti, you may get a shock. But he says, although he cannot be withstood by someone of my feeble defences, still, sustained by the grace of the Buddha, I will go to him and will converse with him as well as I can. The word translated here as grace is the Sanskrit word adhisthana, which certainly does not mean grace in the Christian sense. Grace here is the non-dualistic influence of the Buddha's transcendental experience of enlightenment, as that influence appears within the framework of the dualism of subject and object. Because in reality there is no such dualistic split, this influence cannot really be said to have an external source, but it appears to have one. You could see Adisthana as a powerful influence emanating from a powerful spiritual source, an influence which can have a radically transforming effect on you if you open yourself up to it. But it is not automatic, which is why grace is not really an adequate translation. It is not exactly that you have to earn it, but it certainly is related to your capacity to receive it. Even on an ordinary level, if you experience goodwill coming from another person, that will have an effect on you. Your state of consciousness will be altered in some degree, and you will respond on that basis. In the same way, on a higher level, if you can experience goodwill coming from a person who has some spiritual realization, even some insight into the nature of reality, presumably that will have an even greater effect on you. In fact, Adisthana is flowing from the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas all the time, just as light and heat are constantly radiating from the sun. And you will be benefited by it to the extent that you are receptive to it. In Tibetan, Adisthana is translated as Chin Lab, which literally means power wave. Chin also has connotations of majesty and splendor. We tend to understand the word power in a purely secular sense. But the power of the transcendental is more like power in the sense of love, a powerful expression of metta. Perhaps one could speak of a love wave, or even a blessing with a great deal of strength behind it. Adisthana is something which seems to come from above rather than arising from below. It is something which is given to one. It is like artistic inspiration. Usually inspiration is spoken of as coming up from the depths, but sometimes it seems to come down from some higher power. After hearing the first performance of his oratorio, The Creation, Haydn is said to have murmured, "It came from above." So Adisthana is perhaps analogous to the artist's invocation of the muses, where one addresses oneself to higher powers and asks for their blessing. This raises the question of the nature of effort in the spiritual life. We need, it seems, to make the effort to be receptive, but this may sound like a contradiction in terms. Is it possible to invoke the muses so vigorously that you can't hear them singing? Take the example of playing in an orchestra. You are making a tremendous effort, but at the same time you are being receptive. Are the two things really so antithetical? Do you have to stop doing everything in order to be receptive? Or take the art of writing. You can be making a very intense effort, but at the same time you do feel receptive. Something is flowing into you. The problem seems to be that we make the wrong kind of effort. This happens when you try to appropriate a higher experience as something to be incorporated into your existing being, when what you should be doing is incorporating your existing being into the experience in such a way that your existing being is transformed. This effort, which is really just willful exertion, is an attempt to retain the experience within the existing structure of your being without allowing it to change you. Until enlightenment is attained, there will always be a conflict between appropriating and experiencing, between incorporating and surrendering. It is no good thinking that all effort is willful effort and therefore to be avoided. The solution to the problem of willfulness is not simply to take things easy. It may be that the effort you make is not distributed over a broad enough spectrum of interests, so that your spiritual life becomes rather one-sided and you lose your motivation. If you are working in a right livelihood business, you may need to make an effort, even a great effort, to apply yourself to the work. But at the same time, you need to make effort in meditation, in spiritual friendships, and so on. It is not that you have been placing too much stress on effort, but that the effort is not distributed sufficiently widely. There are two ways of solving this problem. You can either make some provision in the course of every day or over a week or a month for all your requirements or interests to be met, or else you can spend a few weeks, even a few months, concentrating on one, then a few weeks or months concentrating on another, and so on. Either way, over the period of, say, a year, all your requirements would be met. However, Manjushri does not have any such problems when he makes the effort to visit Vimalakirti on his sickbed, because he is sustained by the grace of the Buddha. What Manjushri means by Adhisthana is that he is not going to see Vimalakirti under his own steam, as it were. He is not going to embark on the visit with any fixed idea. He is going to deal with the situation spontaneously, which means that he is not even going with the fixed idea of acting spontaneously. When Manjushri says he will go and see Vimalakirti, everybody in the assembly, except of course the Buddha, who just sits there smiling through it all, gets tremendously excited. They think that if these two come together, there will be a wonderful discussion, a real clash as between two symbols, out of which something truly profound and illuminating will emerge. So, 6,000, a quarter of the Bodhisattvas, and 500, one-sixteenth of the Arhants, decide to accompany Manjushri on his visit. No doubt these numbers have some significance. Many hundreds of thousands of gods and goddesses also decide to go, so a great retinue accompanies Manjushri on his journey to the city of Vaishali. Fully aware of their approach, Vimalakirti exercises his magical power and makes everything around him disappear. The house itself, all his attendants, all the furniture, the seats, the couches, everything vanishes. All that can be seen is old Vimalakirti himself, lying on his couch, suspended in mid-air. At this point, Manjushri arrives. It would not be quite accurate to say that he enters, because there is no door to enter by, and no floor to walk on. But no doubt Manjushri, being the Bodhisattva of wisdom, manages to overcome that little problem. On seeing him, Vimalakirti takes the initiative, calling out, "Welcome, Manjushri. You are very welcome. There you are, without any coming. You appear without any seeing. You are heard without any hearing." Manjushri is not at all disconcerted by this style of greeting. He is quite equal to the occasion. He replies, "Householder, it is as you say. Who comes, finally comes not. Who goes, finally goes not. Why? Who comes is not known to come. Who goes is not known to go. Who appears is finally not to be seen." Then, having answered Vimalakirti in his own terms, Manjushri goes on quite coolly to carry out his purpose and ask Vimalakirti about his sickness. He tells Vimalakirti that the Buddha has been inquiring after him, and finally he says, "Householder, whence came this sickness of yours? How long will it continue? How does it stand? How can it be alleviated?" These questions take the form of the standard polite Indian inquiries. But Vimalakirti's reply, it is not at all standard. and it constitutes one of the most famous and impressive passages in the whole of the Vimlakirti Nidesha. He says, "Manjushri, my sickness comes from ignorance and the thirst for existence, and it will last as long as do the sicknesses of all living beings. Were all living beings to be free from sickness, I also would not be sick. Why? Manjushri, for the Bodhisattva, the world consists only of living beings, and sickness is inherent in living in the world. Were all living beings free of sickness, the Bodhisattva also would be free of sickness. For example, Manjushri, when the only son of a merchant is sick, both his parents become sick on account of the sickness of their son, and the parents will suffer as long as that only son does not recover from his sickness. Just so, Manjushri, the Bodhisattva loves all living beings as if each were his only child. He becomes sick when they are sick, and is cured when they are cured. You ask me, Manjushri, whence comes my sickness? The sicknesses of the Bodhisattvas arise from great compassion." This is Vimlakirti's reply, and his words resound throughout the history of Mahayana Buddhism. But what he is talking about, the Bodhisattva's experience of Mahakaruna, great compassion, does present us with an intractable mystery. For us, bliss and pain are essentially incompatible. So how does a being who, under all circumstances, experiences the bliss of liberation, also experience the suffering that Vimlakirti describes? We could say that it is an aspect of experiencing wisdom and compassion, prajna and karuna, as non-different. That is, it is an aspect of the Bodhisattva's compassionate response to suffering as being not different from the same Bodhisattva's profound realization of the emptiness of all things, including living beings and their suffering, and the profound realization itself, of course. We could say that it is an aspect of being in nirvana and samsara at the same time. If that is possible, presumably it is possible to experience the bliss of emancipation at the same time that one suffers with beings through great compassion. However, we are still in the realm of theory. Perhaps we can find a mundane, if rather faint, analogy for the experience of Mahakaruna in the way we are able to remain fully absorbed in doing something, like playing a strenuous game, while at the same time receiving some painful knocks. Up to a certain point, we don't really notice the pain, or rather we don't take notice of it. It is there, we feel it, but it is very much at the periphery of our consciousness because we are so absorbed in the game and finding it so enjoyable. Perhaps it is not even enjoyment. We are just so caught up in the game that we don't really think about whether we are enjoying it or not. The Bodhisattva really feels for beings rather than suffering with them. He certainly doesn't suffer in the same way or in the same sense that they do. This is because he is enlightened, and their suffering is due to their being unenlightened. His suffering is a sympathy rather than an actual experience of suffering. And just as it is impossible actually to experience the toothache that another person experiences, however sympathetic you are, so the Bodhisattva can never experience the suffering of not being enlightened. The Bodhisattva's suffering is, in Tennyson's words, a painless sympathy with pain, which in a way involves a pain of its own. And this pain is very different, both in quality and in degree, from the kind of sympathy that we might feel. To some people, indeed, a Bodhisattva's sympathy might not seem like sympathy at all, inasmuch as it would not be an indulgent kind of sympathy. Vimlakirti's account of the sickness which arises from great compassion is all very sublime, very deep, very true, very heartfelt. But Manjushri is not satisfied. He is not going to let it rest there. So more brisk dialectical exchanges between Manjushri and Vimalakirti follow, in the course of which Vimalakirti becomes very paradoxical indeed. After this, in reply to another question from Manjushri, Vimalakirti explains how a bodhisattva should console another bodhisattva who is sick. He also explains at great length how a sick bodhisattva should control his mind, and this is followed by a long passage about the nature of the domain of the bodhisattva. Among Vimalakirti's many descriptions of this domain, there is this rather baffling specification. Where one seeks the gnosis of omniscience, yet does not attain this gnosis at the wrong time, there is the domain of the bodhisattva. Where one knows the four holy truths, yet does not realize those truths at the wrong time, there is the domain of the bodhisattva. What might this mean? How can there possibly be a wrong time for the realization of the Four Noble Truths, a wrong time for enlightenment? The wrong time to attain this gnosis is when the realization is sufficient to gain arhantship, but not sufficient to gain full enlightenment. If there is a real distinction between Samyaksambodhi, supreme enlightenment, and arhantship, then you need more wisdom to gain Samyaksambodhi than to attain arhantship. And if you are a bodhisattva, you want to gain Samyaksambodhi, so you don't develop the gnosis of omniscience as a basis for becoming merely an arhant. Of course, the whole distinction between Samyaksambodhi and arhantship is an artificial one, inasmuch as it is a function of the historical development of the Mahayana. But there is a general point to it which holds good. One shouldn't settle down in a partial experience of enlightenment, even though it may be a genuine experience of enlightenment so far as it goes. To the extent that there is anything further to realize, one must continue to make an effort. Even the Buddha's enlightenment was not final. He didn't settle down in a state of realization, which thereafter remained the same. There can't literally be a wrong time for enlightenment, but there is the possibility that one will settle down in and take as ultimate an experience, whether of omniscience or of the Four Truths, which is in fact only partial. The real mistake is to imagine that enlightenment represents a sort of conclusion to one's development. If you don't make this mistake, then even if you do attain some kind of gnosis, you won't make the mistake of resting on your laurels. You won't think you're enlightened when you're not. This is what the text is really getting at. And the effect of the whole discourse is such that in 8,000 of those listening to Vimalakirti, the bodhicitta, the spirit of unexcelled perfect enlightenment, as the text calls it, is awakened. So the meeting between Vimalakirti and Manjushri has a dramatic effect, and it continues to do so over the next four chapters of the Vimalakirti Nidesha. In fact, their confrontation is one of the main features of the whole work, and it is this that I now want to explore at greater length, the figures of Manjushri and Vimalakirti facing each other, just as I saw them in that ancient Chinese mural in 1956. This meeting is more than a confrontation. It is a vigorous dialectical exchange in which neither bodhisattva spares the other. In a sense, each is out to win, to defeat the other, but not in an egoistic way. Each is testing the other, just as a potter tests an earthenware pot to see whether it is cracked. In this confrontation, each experiences or tests the other. At the same time, each experiences or tests himself in contact with the other. Each experiences the truth, the reality of the situation. The contest between them therefore takes place within a context that is completely positive. Blake says, opposition is true friendship. Friendship, especially spiritual friendship, is not sentimental and indulgent. It is vigorous, challenging, demanding, bracing, invigorating, stimulating, like a cold shower, not a warm bath. In the last chapter, we saw Vimalakirti offering this kind of vigorous friendship to the various arhants and bodhisattvas. They were not quite able to stand up to it. It was rather too much for them. But Manjushri is equal to the challenge. The two are, in fact, more or less evenly matched, so they can be friends. Nietzsche takes Blake's aperçu even further, saying that one's enemies are really one's friends. The greater the enemy, the better the friend. Towards the end of chapter 6 of the Vimalakirti Nidesha, Vimalakirti himself says much the same thing in his own way. Mahakashyapa, one of the arhants, has just exclaimed, "What could the entire host of Maras, the evil ones, ever do to one who is devoted to this inconceivable liberation?" To which Vimalakirti replies, "Reverend Mahakashyapa," they are always very polite to each other in these Mahayana texts, "the Maras who play the devil in the innumerable universes of the 10 directions are all bodhisattvas dwelling in the inconceivable liberation, who are playing the devil in order to develop living beings through their skill in liberative technique." Reverend Mahakashyapa, all the miserable beggars who come to the bodhisattvas of the innumerable universes of the 10 directions to ask for a hand, a foot, an ear, a nose, some blood — they do all these things in the Jataka stories — muscles, bones, marrow, an eye, a torso, a head, a limb, a member, a throne, a kingdom, a country, a wife, a son, a daughter, a slave girl, a horse, an elephant, a chariot, a cart, gold, silver, jewels, pearls, conches, crystal, coral, beryl, treasures, food, drink, elixirs, and clothes. These demanding beggars are usually bodhisattvas living in the inconceivable liberation, who, through their skill in liberative technique, wish to test and thus demonstrate the firmness of the high resolve of the bodhisattvas. Why? Reverend Mahakashyapa, the bodhisattvas demonstrate that firmness by means of terrible austerities. Ordinary persons have no power to be thus demanding of bodhisattvas unless they are granted the opportunity. They are not capable of killing and depriving in that manner without being freely given the chance. Reverend Mahakashyapa, just as a glowworm cannot eclipse the light of the sun, so, Reverend Mahakashyapa, it is not possible without special allowance that an ordinary person can thus attack and deprive a bodhisattva. Reverend Mahakashyapa, just as a donkey could not muster an attack on a wild elephant, even so, Reverend Mahakashyapa, one who is not himself a bodhisattva cannot harass a bodhisattva. Only one who is himself a bodhisattva can harass another bodhisattva. Reverend Mahakashyapa, such is the introduction to the power of the knowledge of liberative technique of the bodhisattvas who live in the inconceivable liberation. In the last chapter, we saw how Indra, the king of the gods, approached the bodhisattva Jagatimdara and offered him 12,000 heavenly maidens, which Jagatimdara refused, and how Vimalakirti came along and said that it was not Indra at all, but Mara, the evil one. But in the light of this passage, it seems we can go even further than that. Yes, Indra was Mara, but, and this is the question we must put aside as simply a subject for reflection, who was Mara? The positive aspects of confrontation explain why Vimalakirti and Manjushri represent what I have called history versus myth in our quest for meaning. But what do I mean by our quest for meaning? And we might well ask, as modern scholars, critics and philosophers have asked, what meaning means in any case. It is not even altogether self-evident what we mean by history and myth. And how does history oppose myth? We shall be going into these questions, but we shall not be going into them very systematically or directly. We shall simply be bringing out some of the implications of the scene depicted in that mural painting. The painting itself is the real answer, the direct answer. That is, the answers are to be found, sought and found, in terms of vision and imagination. Let us start with the figure of Vimalakirti. First of all, he is an old man. He has a long, white, wispy beard, even long, white, wispy eyebrows, and a puckered, wrinkled, but cheerful and humorous old face. It is quite obvious that he is subject to the process of time, as are we all, even though we might not be wrinkled and white-haired, with or without the wispy beard, yet. Not only is Vimalakirti subject to time, he also lives at a particular point in time. He lives at the time of the Buddha, which according to modern scholarship is the 6th century BCE. He is also subject to space. He lives in a particular part of the world, in the great Indian mercantile city of Vaishali. He lives in a particular part of the city, in a particular house, even though at the beginning of chapter 5 he makes it disappear. He has a particular personal identity. He is known by a particular name and belongs to a particular social group. He follows a particular occupation, being apparently engaged in some sort of business, and has, or appears to have, a wife and children. Vimalakirti thus has a historical personality, a historical existence, an existence which is specific, concrete, contingent, an existence which is determined by time, space and causality. Vimalakirti therefore represents historical reality. This does not necessarily mean, incidentally, that he actually existed. This is indeed a matter for dispute among modern Western scholars. What it means is that Vimalakirti is depicted in the Vimalakirti Nidesha as a historical personality. Manjushri, on the other hand, is a young man. In fact, he is eternally young. That is, he is not subject to the process of time. He does not live at any particular point in time. Nor is he subject to space. He doesn't live in any part of the world. Chinese Buddhists did try to locate him on Mount Wutai, one of the 5 sacred mountains of Buddhist China, but their attempt was not very successful. However, while he is not bound to any particular time or place, he can appear at any time and in any place. Moreover, while Manjushri has a particular personal identity, it is not a mundane identity. His name is a known name. He doesn't belong to any particular group, doesn't follow any particular occupation. He just does, as occasion arises, whatever is necessary to help living beings develop. And he certainly doesn't have even the semblance of a wife and children. Manjushri thus has no historical existence. He is not a historical personality. He has an existence which, in a manner of speaking, is specific and concrete, but which is not contingent, not determined by time, space, or causality. He has what may be called a transcendental existence, a glorified individuality, as his physical appearance suggests. He is not only young, but extremely beautiful. He is clad in silks and jewels, and his entire body is surrounded by an aura of brilliant golden light. Manjushri therefore represents supra-historical or archetypal reality. He represents myth. Myth, that is, understood loosely rather than in any literal sense of the word. In fact, the word does not really have a literal sense. In recent times, a whole industry has been set up to explain the meanings of ancient myths. But myths cannot really be explained or understood in a conceptual sense. The meaning of myths, of myth in general, has to be felt, experienced, enacted, lived. If you take a myth in the modern, sophisticated sense, it has its effect on you. But if you are able to believe that the myth is literally true, it has a much greater effect. For instance, if you are a Christian and you believe that the resurrection of Christ has a deep symbolical significance, even though he didn't literally rise from the dead, the resurrection is a very meaningful symbol for you. But if, as an Orthodox Christian, you believe that Christ literally rose from the dead because he was the Son of God and he had that power inherent in him, your belief will have much deeper foundations, or at least you will be more strongly motivated. The nature of our approach to myth is one of the basic questions that have to be faced nowadays, not only by Christians, but by Buddhists as well. For Buddhists, however, it is not such a key issue, because in Buddhism, especially early Buddhism, the taking of myth as literal truth doesn't occupy such an important place. If you read, for example, that the Buddha walked up and down in the air, emitting water and fire at the same time, you can believe that quite literally and no doubt find it inspiring. But taking that myth, if it is a myth, literally, doesn't occupy the kind of central place in Buddhism that belief in the resurrection of Christ occupies in Christianity. There is no doubt, however, that if you are able to take myth as being literally true, you are likely to practice your religion more zealously and energetically. Of course, such literal belief can go to the undesirable extreme of fanatical fundamentalism. But in avoiding that, perhaps we need to take care not to fall into too sophisticated or rational an approach to myth. The whole point about the realm of myth is that it is a realm not of clearly defined meanings, but of undefined, even indefinable meanings. To this realm also belong such things as symbols, archetypal images, the imagination itself, and poetry. But just where does Manjushri come from? Where does myth come from? We need be in no doubt about Vimalakirti's origin. Like Gautama the Buddha, he is represented as a historical personality playing his part on the stage of history. But the figure of Manjushri requires some explanation. He is not found in the Pali scriptures. How did he get into Buddhism? How did he get into the pages of the Vimalakirti Nidesha? How did he get into the Buddha's assembly? We can begin to answer this question by reaching back to the Pali scriptures, which are the records of the Buddha's teaching kept by the Theravada, or School of Elders, one of the earliest schools of Buddhism. Although these scriptures were not written down until several hundred years after the Buddha's Parinirvana, the oldest parts of them undoubtedly reflect, at least to some extent, the conditions under which Gautama the Buddha lived and taught, and the form that his teachings assumed. We find in them a great deal of information about the political situation, social conditions, economic life, manners and customs, religious beliefs and superstitions prevalent in the India of the Buddha's time. They are, in fact, our main source of information about northern India during this period. The result is that in the Pali scriptures, we find the Dharma deeply embedded in its historical context, even overlaid to some extent by that context. We find a Buddhism which is a historical phenomenon. a Buddhism which is determined by time, space and causality, a Buddhism which exists and expresses itself in terms of historical reality, but which is also obscured and concealed by that historical reality. Like the figure of Vimalakirti, the Buddhism of the Pali scriptures belongs to the realm of historical rather than archetypal reality. It is true that some elements of myth are found in the Pali scriptures, but these are found in a rudimentary, though still very beautiful form, mainly in parables and extended similes. By contrast, the elements of historical reality found in the Mahayana sutras occupy a distinctly subordinate place. For instance, in the Vimalakirti Nidesha, we find ourselves in Amrapali's garden and in the city of Vaishali, but into this realm of homely historical reality, there erupts the realm of archetypal, even spiritual reality. Or, to put it another way, the realm of homely historical reality is made to open up in all directions into the realm of archetypal reality, as when Vimalakirti or the Buddha performs a miracle or puts on a display of magical power. The origins of the Mahayana Sutras lie partly in the dissatisfaction of some early Buddhists with the Pali scriptures. They were not satisfied with the expression of Buddhism in terms of historical reality. They were not interested, as nowadays we are only too often interested, in Buddhism as a historical phenomenon. The notion of history in the modern sense was in any case probably quite unknown to them. For them, the Dharma really was Sanantana, eternal. They wanted to free it from its historical context, to emancipate it from the limitations of a merely historical existence. They were interested, we could say, in what the Buddha said rather than in the historical conditions under which he said it. They were committed to the Dharma as a living spiritual reality. Consequently, they tended to forget the historical situation in which the Buddha lived and taught. It didn't seem very important to them. Instead, they concentrated more and more on the Buddha as a purely spiritual personality and on the Dharma as a purely spiritual truth whose deeper implications they sought to bring out. Thus, they sought not only to emancipate the Dharma from the limitations of history, but also to universalize it, to reformulate it in such a way as to make it applicable not just to the people of northern India in the 6th century BCE, but to all living beings throughout time and throughout space. This was, of course, implicit in the Dharma as the Buddha taught it. He taught it, after all, Bahujana Hitaya, Bahujana Sukhaya, for the welfare and happiness of many people. But the forebears of the Mahayanists felt that the universal quality of Buddhism needed to be made more explicit. This dehistoricizing, universalizing, idealizing tendency was one aspect of the development of what later came to be known as the Mahayana, which eventually found expression in the Mahayana Sutras. Another element the Mahayanists brought to the teachings was a love of adornment and decoration. A friend of mine once remarked, "That which we love, we adorn." If this is true, the Mahayana scriptures show us how very much those who originated them must have loved the Dharma, because they adorned it magnificently. They set it in an ideal archetypal realm, flashing with light and glowing with all the colours of the rainbow, a realm where everything was made of jewels, and the air was filled with music and perfume. In short, they transferred the Dharma from the realm of historical reality to the realm of spiritual reality, from the realm of history to the realm of what I have called myth. We can see this process most clearly, perhaps, in the development of the figure of the Buddha himself. In the Pali scriptures, the Buddha appears as a wandering religious mendicant. The texts describe him as shaven-headed, but we must not imagine him with a shiny pate. His head and chin were probably covered in a heavy stubble. His robes were not the bright, carefully laundered garb of the modern bhikkhu, but ochre-coloured rags. He carried a wooden or metal begging bowl. From a distance, he must have been indistinguishable from the thousands of other wandering ascetics who thronged India in his time, and still do today. The Pali scriptures themselves describe occasions on which the Buddha was not recognized by other people, even by bhikkhus at close quarters. But it is impossible to mistake the Buddha of the Mahayana for anyone else. He appears, as he appears in the Mahayana scriptures, he is seated on a lofty, elaborate, jewelled throne with a canopy of jewels suspended, glittering, above his head. The begging bowl in his lap appears to be carved from a solid block of lapis lazuli or emerald, and a brilliant golden light radiates from his head and body. He teaches the Dharma not just for a few hours or a few years or the span of a human life, but for age upon age without pause. He teaches it in a purely spiritual or archetypal realm to hundreds of thousands, even millions of living beings. Some of these beings, like arhants such as Ananda, are figures familiar to us from the Pali scriptures, but others are not familiar to us at all. And among these unfamiliar figures are the bodhisattvas, including, of course, Manjushri. So if you read the Pali scriptures and then the Mahayana scriptures, say two or three volumes of each, enough to give you a taste of them, you will notice that you get something from the Mahayana scriptures that is completely missing from the Pali texts. This is not by any means to dismiss the unique historical and spiritual importance of the Pali scriptures. They give us a vivid and deeply moving picture of the life and teaching career of the human historical Buddha. They contain all the basic spiritual principles and practices from which all the subsequent forms of Buddhism developed. They are rich in content and full of inspiration. We cannot possibly dispense with the Pali scriptures. As Buddhists, we are enormously indebted to them. Humanity, in fact, is indebted to them. They cannot be praised enough, and we cannot be sufficiently grateful for them. They do not, however, contain everything that everybody needs. There is an element missing, and it is this element that we find in the Mahayana scriptures. Reading the Mahayana scriptures, we are emancipated from the contingent and the determinate, from time, space and causality, from historical reality. We experience archetypal reality, myth, the realm of undefined meanings. In technical terms, we encounter the Sambhogakaya, that is, we encounter the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas of the Mahayana in their archetypal forms. Through this experience, we contact something within us of which we were not previously aware. Something is sparked off that even the Pali scriptures were unable to spark off. And this happens because the realm of archetypal reality, of myth, of undefined meanings, corresponds to something within us. According to the Tibetan Book of the Dead, we experience this realm directly when we die. In the intermediate state between death and rebirth, we experience all sorts of visions, including visions of Buddhas and Bodhisattvas, in both their peaceful and their wrathful forms. And the Buddhist tradition tells us not to be afraid, but to recognize all these visions, all these Buddhas and Bodhisattvas, as our own thought forms, as phenomena of our own true mind. If we can do this, we attain liberation on the spot. As a writer, one inevitably notices a difference in feeling between the experience of composing passages of conceptual prose and the experience of writing something more creative, more inspired or poetic. It is this kind of shift we feel when we make the transition from the prose of the Pali scriptures to the poetry of the Mahayana scriptures, the transition from history to myth on a grand scale. Unfortunately, some people cannot make this transition. Take the well-known case of Charles Darwin. As a young man, Darwin loved poetry and literature, especially Shakespeare, but for the greater part of his life he immersed himself in scientific research. When, as an old man, he tried to get back to Shakespeare, he found, to his dismay, that poetry held no meaning for him any more. He had lost his capacity to enjoy it. In the course of his years, even decades, of scientific research, a whole side of him had withered and died. Much the same happened to John Stuart Mill, at least for part of his life. Even as a small boy, his favourite subjects were logic and political economy, and as he grew older, he found that he became more and more cut off from poetry. It was not that just that he was cut off from poetry in the literary sense. He was, to put it rather poetically, cut off from the poetry of life. Today we are all exposed to this sort of danger. We all suffer from this sort of deprivation, at least to some extent. We've been suffering from it, in fact, since the Industrial Revolution, at the beginning of which William Blake warned against the loss of what he called the divine vision. He criticised Bacon, Newton and Locke so vigorously because he felt that they tended to limit humanity to the realm of historical reality, the realm of time, space and causality. In his own literary and visual creative work, Blake, of course, was not limited in this way. In his prophetic books especially, he explores the deeper levels of human experience. Blake's profound concern with archetypal forces and forms must explain why he continues to hold such a great fascination for so many people today. Our desire to contact the realm of the archetypal also explains the popularity of tales of myth and fantasy, whether traditional, like the stories of King Arthur, or modern, like The Lord of the Rings, and some forms of science fiction. Such works explore facets of humanity's quest for meaning, and in reading them we are trying, perhaps unconsciously, to break out of the prison of merely historical reality, seeking to experience a deeper meaning to our existence. Meaning is not a thing that you can grasp by looking in a dictionary. Meaning must be meaning for you, something that you personally experience. Our quest for meaning is therefore our quest for ourselves, our quest for the totality, the wholeness of our own being. On one level, we belong to the realm of historical reality, but on another, we belong to the realm of spiritual reality. The Mahayana scriptures reveal this world to us. So does myth, so does poetry. And they reveal it to us not as something external to ourselves, but as our own world, as a world in which we ourselves actually live, usually without knowing it. It was a maxim of the Neoplatonists that the eye could not behold the sun unless it had within its nature something sun-like, something akin to the sun. Similarly, we can experience the archetypal realm only because we ourselves are, on another level, archetypal beings. If we really allow ourselves to become absorbed in a Mahayana Sutra, we become part of it. We join the Great Assembly and experience ourselves right in the midst of it, taking part in the events of the Sutra as they unfold. But although we can make the transition to the realm of archetypal reality, this does not mean that we leave the realm of historical reality behind. We cannot, we must not, opt for myth and discard history. We need both, because we exist in both realms. We exist in them both all the time, whether or not we are aware of it. And of course, a lot of the time, we are not aware of it. Our relation to the archetypal realm is analogous to our relation to the dream state. When we are asleep and dreaming, We exist, one might say, in the dream realm, and we have all sorts of experiences. When we wake up, we are no longer in the dream state, but the emotions we experience while we are dreaming continue. It's just like an underground river that we descend into from time to time through a hole in the ground. Just as the river is flowing all the time, so there is continuity between dreams. You can even have a dream, wake up, and then fall asleep again and continue with the same dream as though it has been going on all the time. So in a sense, we are living in that dream realm all the time. And we can extend that to the realm of archetypal experience. Just as a very strong dream continues to have its effect when we have woken up, so the archetypal realm continues to affect us whether or not we are conscious of it. There is no question, therefore, of our literally passing from one realm to the other. They do not even exist side by side. In the mural painting, Vimalakirti and Manjushri confront one another in a vigorous encounter. This is history versus myth, and what we have to do is bring them together. There has to be a sort of marriage between Vimalakirti and Manjushri. We have to realize that Vimalakirti is Manjushri, and Manjushri is Vimalakirti. Time is eternity. Eternity is time. Rupa is Shunyata. Shunyata is Rupa. If we can realize that, then history and myth will have played their part in humanity's quest for meaning. And that quest for meaning, our quest for ourselves, will be complete.